This is A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. Open, authentic, and engaging conversations about autism. Made for autistic people, parents, and carers of children on the autism spectrum. Welcome to A Different Brilliant.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Different Brilliant Aspects podcast. I am your host, Madeline Jane Lobsey, and I'm very excited to be joined today by the spectacular. I hope you're all watching the video because it's worth it. Anna looks like a mermaid with golden hair all the way down, almost to her waist. But Anna James, and Anna is a positive behaviour support practitioner and supervisor in Aspect's Melbourne team. Before this, Anna was a special education teacher for 9 years, and she's dedicated to building her participants' independence, autonomy, and increasing the quality of life for them. Anna is passionate about supporting autistic children and young adults to find their voice, thrive, and flourish. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to talk about something today that I think if you're in the autistic community, you probably have heard this term before. But maybe not. And we're going to dive into a term that is pathological demand avoidance. And sometimes you'll hear it like PDA. And we're going to talk about what it is and, you know, some of the ways that it looks when you're living with that. And then strategies and things we can do that leave everybody empowered. So that's the point of today. It's a massive subject, and we're going to see how far we dive in. So why don't we just start with some simple stuff, Anna, which is, you know, this is a term, pathological demand avoidance. Mm. What is it? How did we get to that? Just give us a bit of background.
Well, pathological demand avoidance was first coined by Elizabeth Newson back in the 80s. And since then, we have moved towards more neuroaffirming names such as persistent drive for autonomy or pervasive drive for autonomy, and lastly, protective drive for autonomy, which is a lesser known name, but pathological demand avoidance is what's most commonly used in the research. Mm. The term itself is identified as part of a behavioral profile of autism. It doesn't mean that every autistic individual will have a PDA profile, but we do know that some of them tend to experience PDA. What it really means is profound or extreme anxiety, and it manifests over everyday ordinary routines and demands, even when it's something that the person wants to do.
Yeah. So I think that's probably a really important part, the part you just said. So First, if we just kind of unpack what you just said, you know, at Aspect, the commitment is a social model for autistic people, and there are clinical terms and a clinical look at things that can, in my own experience and the experience of my family, when something is named, can open up worlds to be able to give people space and understanding when something's happening. So we are talking about something that is quote unquote diagnosed or shown up in someone's behavior, but really we're talking about opening up a world for people where they can be empowered. Because like you say, fundamentally it's often extreme anxiety. And that's horrible for people. And that includes even when you really want to do something. So let's put it in plain English. Like what actually happens for a human being? What can trigger it? What happens it? You know, what's going on when it's there?
What I have seen is the child or the adult, because we know PDA can be both for children and adults. They can be offered to do something that they like doing. Maybe it's going to the shops. Maybe it's swimming. Maybe it's a certain activity. You know that they love this activity, but they decline it. And it's usually because they are experiencing a huge amount of anxiety, but they might not look anxious in the way we expect. We usually think of people who are anxious, maybe they look really nervous, maybe they're shaking, maybe they look fearful. Our PDAs are very confident and they will confidently say no to what they've been offered, even if it's something that they really like or want to do.
And that's very powerful, the thing you just said, because, you know, another whole conversation, but one of the ways that life can be for an autistic person is masking. So you've got a lifetime of hiding your experience of life, and I think for many people you could look at someone who's just simply going no and think either, okay, they don't want to do it, or they're a bit of a jerk who's, you know, being really negative about something they love.
Absolutely. And we have seen, I've seen a really good move towards people understanding PDAs can't. They can't do what you're asking. They can't meet the expectations. They can't follow through with the instructions because of that level of anxiety. But what people often think of is they won't do it. Mm. And it's so different for them. It's not about won't, it's about can't. And with the masking, it can be really confusing for people to understand that PDAs are exceptional maskers and they won't show that anxiety when they're in certain environments. Like maybe if they're at school, you'll often hear PDA doesn't have any issues, they're doing really well, they're you know, handing everything in on time, they follow instructions, and then they go home and they struggle. So just because they're able to mask doesn't mean they don't have PDA.
Yeah, that's important. There's going to be a lot of people listening to this. I know in my own household that there's going to be a lot of people listening to this who know the person that comes home from work or comes home from school, and at by that point has been quote unquote holding on all day, and yet you get school reports that talk about how amazing they are, or they keep getting fabulous performance reviews, or you know, it is something that's not easily shown for people. Or they become someone that other people start labelling as resistant.
They really do. And I think there's this notion in the neurodiverse community that if somebody doesn't immediately comply with a demand, that they're defiant. And so through the rise in information about PDA, we're starting to see people understand that people like with PDA don't comply with demands because they can't, and it's not actually this like defiance.
Yeah. So I think we've got to talk more about the can't, because I can only look at my own experience and the experience around me, but I'm sure there's a way that's more research than that that actually says, what do you mean by can't? Like, what's happening for that person?
What I have seen, and this is usually the first indicator that someone is really stressed, is the social strategies will increase. So, and by that I mean they're starting to use excuses. They're trying to avoid, maybe it's a flat out refusal. For one person I work with, he will dip into role play and fantasy, and he'll use a toy and say, you know, Foxy didn't go to primary school, high school or university. He can't answer your question. So that's what we often see at times. It's an increase in social behaviour.
And for the person themselves, I mean, what are they experiencing? Why is it different from won't? What's actually going on that makes it a can't?
We think about the nervous system and how that begins to dysregulate. And we sometimes talk about PDA through the trauma response, so our fight, flight, freeze or fawn responses. And you might think of this as someone who's using physical behaviour, someone who is using verbal strategies to avoid, someone who's suddenly absconding or running out of the room because it's too much. And then for someone who's masking, they're dipping into that fawn response. So they're coping with the situation as best they can to get through it.
Yeah, and I think what's important maybe is to unpack the demand bit too, because, you know, life is full of demands, outward demands, like especially when you're at school, at work, turn up on time, do this, do that, finish this report, do this schoolwork. So there's the obvious demands of life, but there's also things that are not obvious at all that occur like a demand.
Mm.
So what are some of those things?
You could think of them as silent demands, so things that are imposed on others. You could also think of them as more internal demands, like our hygiene, toileting, eating, showering, all of those sorts of things can be demands. Sometimes even the body cues that people are given to go to the toilet, our PDAs can't toilet in a sort of a consistent way.
Yeah, so if we look at that, like if I'm trying to understand what you're saying, right? Mm. So I'm going, hang on a sec, you're saying that their body's saying go to the toilet and they're saying they can't.
Yes.
So at any point where something that seems external from them, including their body, is saying you need to do this, that's when, I hate the word trigger, but it's when that experience can present.
If you think of it as a threat response,
yeah,
that's, I think, helps to unpack what it is. It's the person experiences a threat response, and then we say trigger, it can then trigger a reaction.
Yeah, and it, again, we've got to go back to it includes doing things they want. So you can be a teenager who you know that, you know, you're starting to give off a scent from having not had a shower.
Yes.
You know, and you know that, and you even want to smell good and you want to have a shower, but you have this experience like immobile, I just can't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we see it all the time, even when it's things that they want to do, things they like doing, they can't follow through.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think sometimes, you know, language matters and for some people saying things like pathological demand avoidance is really powerful because there's a use of clinical language that gives them power in life. And I know for other people saying things like, you know, persistent demand for autonomy was life-altering because, you know, I have teenagers around who go, oh, I just want to be autonomous. And that's actually, I'm not broken. There's nothing wrong with me. I just want to experience life autonomously.
Which is beautiful. And I think it's such a neuroaffirming way to rephrase the original term, which, you know, back in the 80s, that's what was used. But using other words like pervasive drive for autonomy or pervasive demand avoidance is such a kind way of speaking about our PDAs.
I imagine parents probably or teachers deal with this a lot. Like, what are some of the ways that they might know that that's happening other than the social stuff?
We tend to see fairly extreme behaviours within PDA. So that can be fight or flight behaviours. Sometimes we think of physical behaviours towards other people. Sometimes it's verbal behaviours. So it may be insults, other things like that.
Yeah, if you take away behaviours, because I know we're trying to soften or not leave anybody lesser than because people are extraordinary, but flat out it can be hitting, biting, yelling, swearing, running,
yes,
you know, all of even personal harm, like hitting a head on a wall or something.
It can be.
Yeah. And that people are living with that, and in those moments it's upsetting for everybody and people can be left powerless in those moments. So what are some of the strategies maybe that can leave the person experiencing that empowered and the people around them empowered?
What I find most of the time is all of that behavior, the hitting, the kicking, the biting, whatever's happening, it's that person's way of saying, I can't do what you want. And most of the time, PDAs want time and space. That's all they want. Give them time and space. In terms of safety, I know that some of these things can be incredibly unsafe for the PDA, but also for the person trying to support them. So safety always comes first. If you really want some good strategies, start with the language. So the language that we use can have a huge effect on whether we activate someone or whether we can help them to de-escalate. And by that I mean declarative language. So we make observations instead of giving direct instructions.
So here I am, I'm right in the middle of it. And what could you say to me?
I might say to you, it's a beautiful day outside. I can see everyone's going out to recess. And then pause and invite the person to make that observation. Or I could say to you, I can see that everybody's opened their books and they're starting to write. At home, it could look something like, you could say to them, it's cold outside, maybe shoes would be a good idea. Just little things, observations
right.
that we can make. And it takes away what we tend to do to PDA is tell them what to do, when to do it, and how to do it, which reduces all of their autonomy.
Yeah, or I think the other thing, I often look at my own strategies that I use and it might basically leave them more in the experience of it. So I will say, I can tell you're really upset right now, or I can tell you're really, you know, not handling this and you need some space. I might even say those things that sound nice and affirming, but can actually draw them further into the experience of it.
It can sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's where often it's really good to just go quiet and be quiet and wait for the PDA to come to you. Wait until they're ready to talk about what's going on, because it gives them the space to process how they're feeling. And they often don't know how they're feeling in the moment.
Yeah, that's certainly my experience. One of the strategies we've used in our household is giving people, and some it doesn't always work. When I'm right in the middle of something, the gears grind to a halt. Mm. There's nothing I'm going to be able to do in that moment. But sometimes what makes a difference is they just have a hand signal that basically is saying to me, I can't talk about this right now, or I can't engage with you about this right now. And even that brings this connection with one of us, like, okay, I got it. I hear you. I'm with you and I'm here and you don't need to say anything.
I think it's a really beautiful way of providing some strategies for them, because there's still that pressure a lot of the time on our PDAs to verbally say what they need or say how they're feeling. And we know that when the stress goes up, often the communication reduces and they might stop speaking, and then we pressure them to keep talking, but they can't. I think
that's important to say, because even people listening to this, like, there'll be, I also don't like this word much, but neurotypical, or people that are not autistic, ADHD, all those, you know, neurodivergent things that are listening to this. And we all know that experience of people asking us things that we don't know the answer to. What do you need right now? You know, like, I don't know that at the best of times.
Right.
Or how can I help you? I don't know. At the best of times. Yeah, but then when someone's right in the middle of something, that's the expectation. You know, you think you go to a restaurant and you're sitting there with the menu and someone says, can I take your order? And that's enough to freak you out in any circumstance, because it's like, I don't know what I want. So I think it's really powerful, the thing you're saying.
It is. And I know I speak clinically, but we know that behavior is not a choice. It's not a choice. These things happen because someone is extremely stressed and they're trying to show you that they can't meet those expectations. And I can give you an example of someone that I work with who was very activated, hitting, kicking, pushing throughout the session together. And at the very end, I said to him, I could see you're really stressed. And he was doing some things that he does to self-soothe, you know, rubbing my earlobe and so forth. And he said to me, I am, but I can't explain it to you. And it was so profound for me, because that's PDA. I can show you, but in the moment I can't explain it. But we expect them to be able to explain what they need.
Man, I just heard every dinner table, every trying to get someone in the car to go to school. Man, it makes me cry. Like, the amount of suffering for people inside homes and environments for everybody because we're trying to demand people act in a way that we say, whoever the, I don't know who we is, the right way we're supposed to behave.
It is. And what I see is when people don't understand what a PDA needs, they push more discipline, they want more compliance, they give them consequences, and it just activates them further.
Yeah, it's a whole other conversation, but I think it's a big part of the mighty school refusal that we deal with, because nobody wants to experience life under a constant trap and dominance. And when your anxiety levels are that high and you're incapable of communicating that, then we start to verge on, and I'm going to say a reactive word, abuse.
We do. And schools, unfortunately, come with 100 demands. There's so many things that we expect people and our students to comply with. But for some PDAs, they actually thrive when they don't have to go to school.
Yeah. Yes, Anna.
Which makes me cringe as a teacher.
Yes.
But as a PBS practitioner, I understand it from the other end now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so one of the things we can do is declarative language. What are some of the – so, yeah, the people – and there are families that go, well, my child needs to go to school. That's important. That's what's going to work for our family. So in those circumstances, what are the other things that even parents can advocate for that happen with the teacher? It's part of what you can develop in a teacher and say, here's what works, or – what are things people can do that would actually make a difference?
A low demand approach. And by that, I mean you need to work with the PDAer to give them full autonomy. So that means negotiating with them every part of the routine. Sometimes we will like lay out all the activities and the PDAer chooses, or they'll have the choice of like what to start, when to start it, how much to do. And then there's exit strategies so that when they're starting to activate and they're stressed, they can opt out and take more breaks to help them regulate.
Okay, so let's break that down, because I'm thinking as a teacher who's got 30 kids in my class going, oh my goodness, that seems like an enormous amount of work. Or I'm thinking about some people who, you know, there are parents who are like, well, I didn't grow up that way and life isn't choices and you've got a deal. And, you know, so there could be a level of resistance to what you're saying.
Yes.
But what I just heard is the investment matters. Like investing in that in the beginning, if you do that a few times and that becomes standard practice, then now you've got a student who you're not having to behavior control all the time, but actually is empowered to participate in school.
Absolutely. And for a family that I have worked with, when I became involved, their children were being sent home multiple times a week on opposite days, and it put a huge amount of strain on them. I worked with the school to increase the declarative language, ensure that the children had enough choice and control, ensure that they had this low demand where they could opt in or opt out when they needed to. And what we saw was this really steady reduction in the anxiety, the school refusal, and then also being sent home because of behaviours. And both those boys are thriving. They're doing really, really well.
I mean, that's just super cool. That's just super cool.
It is.
And look, I think sometimes people hear those words like choice and control and autonomy and all of those things, and they think it's harder or more than what you're saying. But basically you're saying, hey, there's 10 things we all got to do today in class. Let's lay them out. What order do you want to do them in? And when you need a little break, where can you go and come back and finish it? We're not talking about something really complex.
It's really straightforward. It does take thoughtful planning. It takes a whole team to support a PDAer, but once you get the strategies right, everything can fall into place.
Yeah, and that's what I mean by the investment. Like if that investment gets made in kindergarten or year one or year two, you've now got a human being who sees that the world is on their side, sees that strategies can empower them as well. The teacher starts to see that it empowers them. And now, you know, it's not like it's a done deal and you wipe your hands and see you later, but you've now got something that's being built over time. And then you imagine those two boys who you now have thriving going into a workforce and knowing that they can ask for simple things that make a difference for them.
Absolutely.
And we look at all those statistics that everybody's so upset about, you know, education being people not finishing school or low employment rates, all those things for autistic people, that investment could resolve.
It really could. And I think it also comes back to the can't, not won't. Most of our PDAs are really social. They have this big motivation for relationships and peers, and they want to be around their friends, but then they become so overwhelmed that they can't go to school. Mm. So when we invest, like you said, when we invest early on, everything else falls into place for them.
Yeah. Now, I think it's also important to say that there will be people who are 18, 19, 20, 25 who have not had that investment and, you know, now they're wherever they are dealing with that. So what are some of the things that may make a difference for an adult person in life?
It's a really tricky question to answer because it's individual for everyone.
Everybody's in different places in life. Schools are one place, but we're talking everywhere. So I'm going to ask you a massive question and then you're going to have to answer it on behalf of the whole of humanity. Okay? Go ahead.
What we find is education, and it's not just for the person, it's for everybody who is supporting this person, is getting educated in what PDA is, getting educated in what it's not, and then starting to trial a PDA approach and seeing if that works. And by that I mean low demands, maintain autonomy so they've got choice control in and over their entire life. And it is really hard for some people to move away from the traditional approach to parenting or traditional approach to teaching. But
well, also employment, you know, like if we I mean, in many ways, having the whole pandemic thing happen and people going to work from home was revolutionary for people who had been wanting to work from home forever because it allowed for something. But, you know, even what we know works for adults is part of choice and control and autonomy is going, okay, well, the office opens at 9, but I'd like to come in at 10. And that simple moment of choice can make all the difference. But people are nervous about what that means. Like, well, if I let one person come in at 10 when, you know.
Yes.
But what we know is when a human being's empowered in those ways, they're more productive, they're happier, an entire environment can shift. The culture of an organization can shift when someone's really empowered.
It definitely can. And I think we have to trust our staff, but also trust that we can give them flexible accommodations and they will thrive.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's what you want. Like I get it from the other end. I was just thinking about it from the other end. Like the times I'm like, are you kidding? We don't get out of the house now. We are not getting on the plane that's going to wherever. Or, you know, I've worked in organizations where it's like, we don't deliver this document now, that potential grant that we're going for is over and we don't get it. So, you know, I've been on the other end too, and I feel like there's probably something smart you could say from that end too about what do we do when, like, here comes the deadline.
Explain the why. PDAs are so curious.
Right.
But we often don't tell them why something has to happen. So if you explain to them, like, why we have to leave right now to catch the flight or why this document has to be handed in to meet a deadline, most of the time that anxiety can resolve and they can then move forwards because they understand what you want.
Yeah, okay. So this is what we're saying is this is simpler than what everybody thinks.
Yeah.
And I'm also hearing if someone's not performing at school, that may be indicative or at work, but also if someone really is and a parent says to you, hey, just so you know, when they come home, they're not okay, that's got to be a valid thing to listen to. And that may be indicative too, you know, or if an employee says to you, hey, I know you're seeing me produce my work, but you should know I'm very stressed. That's got to be listened to.
It does. And like relationships are everything for PDAs. And we often don't give them enough credit for how important relationships are, because it builds the trust and it then opens that communication that someone feels comfortable telling you what's going on for them. And what I often see in schools is that we don't give parents who are doing the very best they can enough compassion. What I sometimes see is, you know, the behavior doesn't happen here. So it's almost like, well, the behavior doesn't exist. But if a parent is coming to you and saying, these are all the things that are happening in my home, listen to them, validate, and then help. That's what they really need most of the time.
Are you telling me that actually listening to people and their needs, no matter what, actually is helpful and works, Anna?
Yes, I am. Rocket science, I know.
It's radical, yeah. Isn't it? It's radical.
Imagine listening to someone.
I know. I know. Well, I guess if there's anything, you know, there might be people here who are very empowered by clinical information. Mm. So is there anything that you could give us from that perspective that might leave people with facts that empower them?
There's a few places to start looking. If you haven't already, go to the PDA Society. They've just done a huge update on all of their information and resources. The other really good place to begin looking is Laura Kirby. She's an English facilitator and she runs courses on PDA, both for school and families. And then the last place to look is Casey Erwick, who runs the Paradigm Shift. She has a lot of information on social media and she's started to give out little tips and strategies that she uses with her two boys and she teaches in her course. So that can also give people some things that they can do with their PDAs.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing is mostly your job is to love them.
Yeah, more than anything.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah. Well, Anna, you have made a complex, makes me cry, a complex conversation accessible. And all of the work you've done and every moment that you've cared for and loved someone while they rub your ear in a therapy session, we appreciate you. And it's been total joy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. If you would like to learn more, visit our website, aspect.org.au, to listen to past episodes or send us a message. Make sure to like or subscribe to A Different Brilliant on your podcast app.